Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to you for the 2017 Dedham Lecture. And it's my first lecture here, so it's a real privilege to welcome you to St Mary's. You may not know, all of you know who I am. I'm Anthony Wilson, I'm the vicar here, and I was appointed back in November last year. And I hope tonight you come with great expectations of what you're going to hear. 'Twas not always so when the faithful gathered in church. Samuel Pepys wrote in his diary for July 1666, "I went to church where we heard a sorry, silly sermon." Richard Baxter, an English Puritan church leader, poet, hymn writer, theologian, wrote this, "I craved the Lord Chancellor's favour to restore me to preach to my people at Kidderminster again. It was but a sad place, a vicarage, and the vicar was a poor, unlearned, ignorant, silly reader that little understood Christianity, but once a quarter he said something which he called a sermon, which made him the pity or laughter of the people." My children tell me that I only work one day a week. That would be quite good, though, just working one day a quarter. So why am I drawing your attention to that? Because in so many places across our land, in the early part of the 16th century, prior to the Reformation, preaching was poor and had an insignificant place in public worship. The clergy were a largely illiterate bunch, and only a few were able to preach. A part answer to that was a compilation of a book of homilies, I'm told, that the clergy were to read out. But this could never take the place of good personal preaching. So local enterprise in many parts of the country took a hand in organizing lectureships to supplement the official Sunday worship. And so in Dedham, as in common with many other places, both locally and further afield, places like Ipswich and Colchester, all appointed lecturers as preachers. And there is a rich heritage of such lecturers in this place, in this church. People like Edmund Chapman, John Rogers, who got the nickname Roaring John Rogers. You can probably well imagine how he preached. Matthew Newcomen, William Cole, and William Burkitt were other early lecturers. But there was an uneasy relationship, if we're honest, between those lecturers and the incumbent of the time, given the reason that most of them were appointed. But fortunately, somebody had foresight, and by the beginning of the 20th century, the two positions were combined, were merged, so that the Vicar of Dedham also became the lecturer. And today, through the initiative of the Dedham Lectureship Trust, the trust itself supports a number of activities within our parish. Its object is the promotion of the principles and the doctrines of the Church of England. One of the things that the trust does is to augment the income of another charity, the William Burkitt Charity, which is responsible for promoting the religious education of children and young people. And one very exciting development in relation to that is that this week, on Thursday, we are going to be interviewing for the position of a children and families worker in this parish, and the finances for that post will be coming from the Burkitt Trust and supported through the Lectureship Trust. So each year, the Trust, as part of its ministry, invites distinguished lecturers to be guest lecturers in Dedham. And it's my great privilege and honour to present to us and to welcome on our behalf Nick Spencer to come and speak to us tonight. Nick, thank you very much for coming. It's been quite an effort. Sadly, there was a difficulty with the train, so I had to make a mad dash down to Chelmsford even, to pick Nick up at 7 o'clock this evening. Nick is the research director for Theos. Might be somebody's telephone if you've got a phone going off. That could be your phone. Nick is the research director for Theos, which is a religion and society think tank. He commissions, edits, and writes on issues of religion, politics, and society, and directs the major projects that Theos are involved with. Over recent years, he's written many books, many of which have personally blessed me in my ministry and leadership. Many books and articles. Most recently, The Mighty and the Almighty, How Political Leaders Do God. And The Evolution of the West, How Christianity Has Shaped Our Values. He writes for The Telegraph and for The Guardian and for other publications, including The Church Times and The Tablet. And he also manages to do some media work, mainly on the radio. So, Nick, it's a real privilege to welcome. We look forward to hearing what you have to say to us. Can I, before he comes up, draw your attention to a couple of things? There are some resources that Nick has bought from Theos, a whole range of easy-to-read and short booklets. Each of them are £5, and they're available at the back. And we are offering you tea and coffee afterwards, so do please feel free to stay. There will be time for questions before that. But we're going to hear from Nick now. Before we do that, I'd like to say a prayer. Shall we pray together? Heavenly Father, we thank you for drawing us together in this church tonight. We thank you for bringing Nick to speak to us. We pray that you would anoint him by your Spirit to speak to our minds and our hearts, to enliven us to your greater purpose and glory. Amen.
Thank you very much indeed. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here and an honour to speak to you tonight, and a relief as well. As I sat at Shenfield Station at 6 o'clock this evening after having moved precisely nowhere for the best part of 2 hours, I was beginning to wonder whether circumstances were colluding against me, but made it in the end. So thank you for having me. I'll talk for about 45 minutes or so, and that'll give us hopefully ample time for questions and disagreement and discussion afterwards. I work for Theos, and Theos is a Christian think tank. We were launched in 2006 with the support of the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster, but I'm always at pains to emphasise that it was the warm spiritual support of both of them rather than the hard financial support of either of them, and we remain independent of any particular Christian denomination. Our objective is, if you like, to tell a better story about Christianity in public life. Better in the sense of more accurate, but also better in the sense of more winsome, more cogent, more thoughtful. And we launched with a report that I wrote back in 2006, Doing God, A Future for Faith in the Public Square. We had our 10th anniversary at the end of last year, and we were in a retrospective mood, but rather than thinking about how the faith landscape had changed in that decade, we wrote something about the future of Christianity in Britain in the 21st century, and it's that I want to speak to you about tonight. We were, as I said, in the retrospective mood, and in doing so, I stumbled across an article that was in The Guardian the day after we launched, entitled Why Theos Will Fail. It was a nerve-wracking moment, because if you've only been in existence for a day or so, and you read an article in the national paper explaining how you're going to fail, you kind of believe the hype. The truly offensive thing in it was that they actually spelt my name wrong. It actually wasn't as dreadful as the headline made out. Martin Newland's point was that we were entering into a public realm, this was a month after the God Delusion had been published, in which there was enormous hostility towards faith, and our attempt to speak intelligently into that cacophony would be unsuccessful. But I like to think we have had some success in the last 10 years or so. And I also like to think the landscape is changing. In one sense, it certainly is. Back in 1968, a respected sociologist called Peter Berger wrote in an editorial in the New York Times, in the 21st century, religious believers are likely to be found only in small sects huddled together to resist a worldwide secular culture. Even by the standards of sociological predictions, it turned out to be pretty poor. And Peter Berger recanted 30 years later in a book called The De-Secularization of the World, in which he said, I think what I wrote, what I and most other sociologists of religion wrote in the 60s about secularization was a mistake. Our argument was that secularisation and modernity go hand in hand. With more modernisation comes more secularisation. It wasn't a crazy theory, it had some evidence for it, but I think it's basically wrong. Most of the world today is certainly not secular, it's very religious, he wrote in 1997, and I think that is still very much the case in 2017, 20 years later. And even in those parts of the world that you might think were exemptions, such as the UK, we still have this extraordinary fascination with this subject. This is just an example of the extent to which The Guardian, which is one of the more secular-minded organs of public discourse today, has been covering and writing about religion in the last, decade, in the first decade of the 21st century. And its interest in atheism and secularism and religion and faith was rising exponentially. So even in those places which you could argue weren't more religious, we are still absorbed and fascinated by the subject. What I'm going to do is take you through three different stages. The first one is to look back at what's happened in the last 10, 20 years or so with regards to Christianity specifically. In the second part, I'm going to ask us to look a little bit wider in the context in which we're operating. And in the third part, I will briefly set out what I think a future, and I want to emphasize it's a possible future for Christianity in the 21st century will look like. So let's start with this. I don't mean to fixate on The Guardian. I know I've mentioned it already three times in the first 5 minutes, but it does have some quite juicy headlines and editorial titles. Christianity, suppose it's gone forever. One of the many articles and editorials we read when we hear new research talking about the level, number of people who call themselves religious or call themselves Christian. It's a little confusing though, because often these headlines and sometimes even the articles mix up various different data lines, which is very important to tease apart. What has happened in the last 30 years or so is that nominal affiliation has fallen off a cliff. The default position of people in this country is no longer to call themselves Christian. This is only affiliation. It's nothing to do with behavior or prayer or belief. This is what people call themselves. Now, less than 50% of people call themselves Christian. It is not insignificant. It is interesting to remark, this is the first time this has happened for probably 1,200 years in this country. And I'm going to get the bad news out of the way first of all, so it's more of an uplifting talk than it might otherwise be. What is really disconcerting is that this looks like it's a cohort effect. Now, what I mean by that is that sociologists say there are three different trends that explain the way things are in society. There's a period effect, an age effect, and a cohort effect. What they are is effectively is a period effect is you believe or do what you do because of the period of time in which you live. The age effect is you believe or do what you do because of the age you are. And the cohort effect is you believe or do what you do because of the cohort into which you were born. So to give examples of those, environmental views are a very good example of a period effect. We tend to believe what we do about the environment because we live in 2017. Political views are a good example of the age effect. You do get more right-wing as you get older. The data says so. Religious affiliation looks like it's an example of the cohort effect. And that's quite a complex chart, but all you need to know is that effectively people born in subsequent decades are less likely to call themselves religious. And that means that the trends we have seen in terms of affiliation in the last 20 or 30 years are likely to increase. So there was a report out, I think it was from the British Social Attitude Survey a week or two ago, talking about the percentage of people, the percentage of Christians, which is shorthand for the percentage of people who call themselves Christian, has fallen. That is going to continue in the decades of the 21st century. And also, and this is another worrying fact that we need to be alert to, One of the reasons for this is that Christianity, and as it happens particularly Anglicanism, has very low stickiness levels. What that means is effectively the chance you have of calling yourself a Christian or a Catholic or an Anglican as an adult, depending on whether you were brought up in a Christian family, a Christian household. And the data show that, roughly speaking, half of people who were brought up in a Church of England household call themselves Church of England when they are adults. Slightly more Roman Catholics do. Much higher proportion of Muslims do, 87%. And about 95% of people who were brought up in a family of no religion become adults of no religion. So they are all serious and worrying statistics. But they're all about affiliation. And what is very often confused in the press is affiliation and attendance. Now, if anyone ever tells you that they know how many people go to church in the UK, they are lying. We do not know. The data are very confusing, partly because we don't have data. And right at the very beginning of the Doing Good report, which I think there are some copies of at the back, there's a short paragraph in which I say, the Sunday after we were founded, so 10 or so years ago, there were approximately 4.5 million people in church in the UK every Sunday, in that Sunday. Next week, there'll be about 4.2 million. That is a sentence which lasts about three lines, and there are about three pages of footnotes for it, because it's based on a whole series of estimates. It seems as if church attendance is declining in the UK, but declining at a much shallower level than affiliation is. There are fewer people going to church, but the decline is less steep than the decline in the number of people who are calling themselves Christians. The complicating factor is that it seems to be smaller denominations and new churches and independent churches and migrant churches which are seeing steady or increasing numbers of people, but they don't really measure very much. Whereas the Anglicans and to a lesser extent the Catholics do measure, and they're declining. So this comes with certain health warnings, and it suggests, as I said, a decline in attendance, but not quite as precipitous a decline. Now there are, as I said, exceptions. This is just an overview. London is an interesting exception in that the rate of number of people attending church is increasing, has increased in the last 15 years or so. That is obviously driven in large part, but not exclusively, by migration, immigration. Cathedrals are an interesting example. You have seen increasing attendance in cathedrals in the last 10, 15 years or so ago. And independent, evangelical, particularly charismatic churches seem to be rising. So there are subplots within the plot. But the overall picture is one of precipitous decline when it comes to identity, what you call yourself, and a steadier decline when it comes to behaviour, going to church. Now, it's important to pause at this point, because this is often where the editorials or the articles stop. And they say, look, this is what's happening with the data with regards to Christianity, we can just wave goodbye to it. But that decontextualizes, it takes the church, it takes Christianity, it takes faith out of what is happening more broadly in society. And you can't do that for reasons that will become clear. Charles Taylor is a highly respected Canadian philosopher, and 10 years or so ago he wrote a book called A Secular Age, which explains how the West became secular, or how it became more secular than it was. It's a brilliant book, it's 800 pages. And on page 737, I've read the whole thing, I promise you. He says at one point, our age is very far from settling into comfortable unbelief. And this is critically important. Because if you looked at the early theories of secularization, they would tell you two things, or the predictions. They would say that as soon as people threw off their religious faith, they would be rational, because we are all fundamentally rational beings. And religion is just this antiquated, outmoded garment that we happen to wear. We would be rational and we'd be happy. Well, Chesterton once had a line about when people stop believing in something, they don't believe in nothing, they end up believing in anything. And there is good reason to suggest that Chesterton's little aphorism is correct. Over the years, we have conducted quite a lot of research at Theos looking at what people do and don't believe. And the percentage of people who hold an entirely consistent, rationalistic, atheistic, materialistic, naturalistic view of themselves and the universe is actually very small indeed. It's probably around 10%, depends how you measure it. A truly secular nation, in one sense of that word at least, would be one in which no one believed in God, no one went to church, no one prayed, no one believed in life after death, and so on and so forth. That emphatically isn't the country in which we live. And this is just one example of this. It's actually quite difficult to find out what percentage of people believe in God, because that question almost invariably elicits the response, what do you mean by believe and what do you mean by God? So more sophisticated surveys grade the level of belief from absolute certainty in the existence of God to absolute certainty in his non-existence, if you like. This is a figure from a while ago, and they've changed slightly, but what you tend to find is there is a spread of opinion, and the percentage of people who categorically say they don't believe in God is a lot smaller when you've cut out people who believe in a higher power or people who are simply agnostic or frankly disinterested as well. And that is nothing compared to when you start asking people about more esoteric spiritual beliefs, their belief in the soul, life after death, heaven, reincarnation, hell, the power of deceased ancestors. Small minorities of people believe in these things, so that the percentage of people from this survey we did who believe that human beings are simply material is 12% there, about 1 in 8 people. So it is not that we don't believe, it is more that we prefer bespoke belief, tailored to my own spiritual needs, concerns, ideas. What has significantly changed is we don't do God. A famous statement from Tony Blair's press secretary, Alistair Campbell, except for the fact that the emphasis I want to put on here is the word do rather than God. We don't do God, as in we're not prepared to go out and join and participate in institutions or organizations that are ordered around the spiritual. We might pray personally, but I'm far less inclined to pray corporately. Years ago, I did some research at a previous organization amongst non-believers or people who weren't Christians. And time and time and time again, these were the different, this is about 4 or 5 different respondents, the different responses we had came back. I don't think you have to go to church to relate to him. If you believe in him, he's always there for you and overlooking you. You can talk, pray, anytime, all the time, it doesn't matter. You can go to church and worship, but I believe anyone can pray to God, and that is why I don't necessarily go to church every week. And rather beautifully, I don't need the church because I've got God anyway. That is the spiritual landscape in which we live. And it was summed up rather beautifully by one of my respondents in a very creative metaphor, in which he said at one point, spirituality is like football, whereas religion is like the football team. Spirituality is like football in that you can have a kickabout with your friends in the park. You can play for as long as you like, where you like, according to the rules you like, according to the pitch you like. The football team means turning up week in, week out. It means playing to an assigned position according to somebody else's rules. It means joining and no longer having fun according to your own lights, but being part of a more regimented and ordered form of playing football. Great analogy, not least because it's got a flip side to it, which is that one of the frequent laments about, if you like, spiritual football, or indeed individualized lives, is that I really miss a sense of community. And what you get with a football team is a sense of community and belonging and training and improving and a goal and an objective. And they're all things that we miss today. So by way of analogy, I would say that religion and spirituality are not like farriers so much as like newspapers. The farrier illustration is one in which once upon a time, 100 years ago, every village had one or more farriers because they were necessary. Nowadays, you might stumble across one, but it's purely entertainment, really, for people who like horse riding. They're not necessary anymore. It's actually more like newspapers. People don't buy newspapers today. The number of under 35s that buy a week daily newspaper is vanishingly small. Does that mean under 35s are not interested in news? Emphatically not. It means they're inclined to consume it and satisfy their desire for news by a different media. And I think that is where we are with spirituality. It's not as if people have lost spiritual yearnings or interest or a sense of purpose or destiny or any of these things. It's just that the historical channels that satisfied them no longer do. A second brief point worth making about our context, as I check my time. As I said, the historic predictions vis-a-vis secularization was, firstly, we would become more rational, and we wouldn't search after issues like the soul or eternal life, let alone the power of deceased ancestors. And we'd be happier. Because when you educate people, particularly when you throw off historic superstitions, we naturally behave well to one another. And we can construct a society that is based on evidence and rational calculation of what is good. Put another way, if the decline in Christianity was combined with a society that was transparently at ease with itself and contented and happy and well-functioning, it would be a very difficult sell for Christianity. Because the question would come back, what's wrong? What's the problem? That isn't the society in which we live. Very important caveat here. We are all blessed for having been born when we have been born and where we have been born. In terms of history's lottery, we are the winners. There are plenty of societies in history and plenty of societies around the world today where we would have lived a much rougher, tougher, shorter life. But that doesn't necessarily translate into a society which is wholly functioning. And in many ways, I think society today is better for me, but worse for us. For me as an individual, it's far less likely to judge me and pressurize me and far more likely to enable me with opportunities that my parents and grandparents didn't have. But I don't think it's so good for us, because if you like, the relational health of a society, of our society, I think is poorer than it once was. And critically, human beings are relational beings. We're constituted by and made by the love of others. And when that gets eroded, no matter how many opportunities I may have as an individual, something is wrong. I have a litany of statistics here, but I won't dwell on them. We don't do bad in terms of our love of neighbour, although we're not brilliant compared to our international neighbours. Our levels of trust in institutions has declined. It's declined precipitously in every single institution, the church included, interestingly, two exceptions, the monarchy, which has managed to survive after a bit of a downward spiral in the 1990s, and the military as well. But by and large, what is, I think, a proper, healthy scepticism about institutions within society has passed through to an unhealthy cynicism. And whereas it is simply the done thing to criticise our political masters, we have to recognise that without ties that bind us and institutions that order our life, we slowly erode our common good. We don't do badly in terms of well-being. You can't see our highlight. Oh, you see our highlight there. We don't do badly in terms of well-being, although it does rather depend what you're measuring, and personal subjective well-being, the kind of me-type well-being, we are reasonably good at, although internationally only middling. And interestingly and importantly, money and well-being became decoupled many years ago. So we've got very considerably richer in the last 40 years or so. We haven't got commensurately happier. And then there are other examples. Our attitude to alcohol is distinctly unhealthy. According to the Lancet, mortality rates from liver disease have increased 400% since 1970. We have severe problems with regards eating disorders. According to a 2015 report by England's chief medical officer, the prevalence of obesity is reaching dangerously high levels and is reaching a national risk. According to a different report published the same year, the cost of eating disorders estimated that 725,000 people in the UK had an eating disorder. Perhaps most worryingly, levels of anxiety, depression, and mental illness are alarmingly high. Mental illness, as you will know, is rapidly rising up the political agenda because it is becoming such a severe problem. Astonishingly, according to the ONS, more than 1 in 10 adults were diagnosed with depression in 2010. I won't go to the other statistics, but that is a particular issue, as is the use of illegal drugs and the level of family breakup and the level of personal debt and material inequality, and perhaps most significantly, the way in which all this affects children. According to a 2016 report from the World Health Organization into health, well-being and social environment, British teenagers felt pressurised at school and worried by health, appearance and weight issues, and are amongst the least happy in the developed world. To emphasise the point, whilst all of those points are serious, and there are people whose lives are blighted by them at the moment, there are two wrong ways of reading that litany of statistics. The first one is to hand-wring and say things are absolutely dreadful and woe is us. As I said, historically speaking, that isn't the case. There are genuine pockets, and sometimes very large pockets, of significant personal need and desperation in our country, though. The second way of reading this, the trite way of reading this, is to say, gospel, just wave the magic wand and everything gets better again. Christianity becomes some kind of silver bullet which just solves all these problems. And we have to recognise that that isn't the case, or at least it's not as simple as that. It's very telling that in the later years of the 19th century, the level of Christian social action was absolutely huge, would put us to shame. And yet, nonetheless, it was Christians who were very often at the forefront of calls for state intervention in the 1880s and 90s, because they began to realise that we, as a church or as churches, couldn't cope with the level of material need and desperation we were coming across. So even in that extremely rich voluntary culture of the Victorian period, people recognised that we needed more, we needed state intervention. But that sets me up for what I want to conclude on, which is to say that amongst those various different data lines that I showed you about affiliation or attendance and so on and so forth right at the beginning, there was one that I didn't talk about. And that is the level of what I will at first call Christian social action. Now there is an inevitable researcher's caveat here, as there is for most researchers who present data. We don't know enough about this yet. If it's relatively straightforward measuring affiliation, rather more difficult measuring attendance, it's woefully difficult trying to measure levels of Christian social action for various methodological reasons that I shan't bore you with. But that caveat noted, all the indicators are that not only is the level of Christian social action not decreasing in the same way as affiliation and attendance are decreasing, but they are actually, it is actually increasing. Here are some examples. The Cinnamon Network is a network for faith groups, the majority of which I think are Christian, getting involved in social action. And they have conducted an audit recently, a few years ago now, which approached about 4,000 local churches and other faith groups. 2,000 responded, and these 2,000 groups aggregated to mobilising 140,000 volunteers, 9,000 paid staff, getting connected with about 3.5 million beneficiaries each year. The time given by churches and other faith groups was estimated to worth over £200 million, though these calculations are always a little bit suspect. And nationally, this puts the time given by churches and other faith groups into communities through social action at about £3 billion a year. I'm inherently nervous about putting pound signs on this because the process of measuring is difficult enough as it is, and then communicate it into material worth. It's very problematic. But in many ways, if you want to influence government, you've either got to have a percentage sign there or a pound sign there, and ideally you've got both. And one of the things that Cinnamon are very good at is trying to translate that into some kind of material estimate. Jubilee Plus, another research initiative, sent out 3 studies at 2-year intervals to their churches, and they are specifically churches rather than faith-based, and they found that over that period of time, churches increased the average number of staff and social action by nearly a fifth. The average number of volunteers increased by a sixth. Spending increased by a seventh. The increased average number of social action initiatives increased by a fifth, and most planned to do more. Now, you might say that these surveys are not representative because you tend to get the positive cases that are responding to you, and there's probably something in that, which is why you've got to take them with slight caution. But a bit more objective is simply the number of charities that are set up and New Philanthropy Capital analysed the database of the NCVO, the National Council for Voluntary Organisations, to find out the number of charities that are being set up, have been set up in recent years and then more distantly, and then splitting them out according to whether they're faith-based or non-faith-based, and what kind of faith they were. And what that shows is that the proportion of faith-based charities founded over recent years is greater than the number of non-faith-based charities, and the number of Christian charities is greater still. Now, again, there's a caveat here. Just because a charity is being set up doesn't actually mean it's doing anything, but the chances are that it will be. These are jigsaw pieces, than the picture on the box. But everything they're suggesting is that in spite of those declining data trends early on, we're seeing an increase in Christian social action. But this is the point where I want to correct that phrase. Action should be crossed out there, and I can't really work out why it isn't. A friend of mine quite a good turn of phrase, has sometimes dismissed Christian social actions as painting railings for Jesus. And what she means by that is that we'll go out into the community and we'll do a good, minor good, and a few people might notice it, but we won't come into contact with anybody, and we certainly won't in any way communicate the gospel to them. And there is a problem here. For those who know their church history, we've been here before. 100 or so years ago, the social gospel movement flourished in America. And it was faithful and it was committed and it was intended to make sure that the material benefits, the practical material benefits of the gospel would be felt throughout society. The problem was that over the years, the gospel element of the social gospel fell off the edge and it just became social action. It became detached, if you like, from its theological heart. For that reason, and because I'm emphatically not saying that the future of the church lies in painting railings for Jesus, I prefer the word liturgy, and Doing Good talks about Christian social liturgy. A number of people have pointed out to me that actually the vast majority of Christians don't know what liturgy is, so what chance have you got to communicate this with non-Christians? And it is a deliberately awkward phrase, but I think it's a helpful one for this reason. It comes from the Greek word liturgia, and that's only used six times in the New Testament. But it's used in 2 distinct ways. One is, if you like, in a obviously what we would call religious sense. the service of a priest or a Levite, a ritual sense in the temple very often. And the second is in a sense of being a charitable gift, a public service in the widest sense. Let's give two examples. In the beginning of Luke's Gospel, when Zechariah's time of service, time of liturgia, was completed in the temple, he returned home. Or the letter to the Hebrews. But in fact, the ministry, or the liturgia of Jesus has received, is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is the mediator is superior to the old one. A more self-consciously religious, God-conscious act. At the same time, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, the liturgia that you perform is not only supplying the needs of God's people, but is also overflowing in many expressions of thanks to God. Or in Philippians, so welcome Epaphroditus, because he risked his life to make up for the liturgia you yourselves could not give me. And there are other non-canonical texts which testify to these different uses of the word liturgia or liturgy. The point about social liturgy is that it is an awkward term, but it's intended to capture the idea of social action, charitable public action, being with and for other people, but doing it in a way that is deliberately God-conscious, deliberately priestly. Not social action here and Sunday worship there. Social liturgy being a form of worship and devotion, of giving of oneself to the other, both to God and to one's neighbour. And I think that is critical to the future of Christianity. Some people asked me after the report, how do you see the future of Christianity in the 21st century? And seeing as these were radio interviews, you had at least 12 words to articulate a 25,000-word report. And in essence, I would say smaller, in the sense of fewer people calling themselves Christian, but more activist, more Christ-like, dare I say it. Let me end with a couple of examples, partly examples of what this means or partly examples of why it's needed. I wasn't aware of this when I wrote the report. A friend alerted it to me because it's much more recent, it's the summer of this year. A survey by Ecclesiastical showing that the social role of churches is invisible. And this is fascinating because we did a piece of work for the Church Urban Fund a few years ago which looked at the number of people who use public services, not statutory services, but services in their local community, and the percentage of those that do so through churches. And broadly speaking, half of adults use some kind of service, and half of those did so in a church. That cashes out as 10 million people in an average year using some form of service, and there was a huge list from food banks to counselling services to IT courses to rehab courses, whatever it is, 10 million people every year engaging in services that the church hosts or provides. Very often, it seems, they may not be aware of those services or aware what's behind them. There is enormous potential there. If that survey showed 100% of people were aware of the services, as in the non-Sunday services, that churches put on, that is the time to worry. That is the time in which we recognise people really, really know what services are going on and they don't care. It's not that they know and don't care, it's very often that they don't know. Here's a little example from an article. One Friday afternoon, I think it was in The Guardian as well, actually. In the late summer of 2014, I walked into a church that I'd never entered, even though it's just around the corner from my home of 17 years in Clapham. It's interesting. I've lived there for 17 years. I've never walked in. I approached a man I had met just once and asked if I could shadow him with my camera for the next year. He was about to go on holiday, and not unreasonably, he said he would need some time to think about it. The Reverend Kit Gunasekara returned from holiday with a yes, which has resulted for me in two outcomes. First, it produced my first photo essay of Things Not Seen, which has just been exhibited in the Oxo Gallery on London's South Bank and attracted several thousand visitors. The work tells the story of Kit's ministry here in Clapham, that so many have seen for themselves the wonderful thing that ministry is, and the profound difference ministry in the church can make in a local community has been hugely rewarding for me. One of my objectives for this whole venture was to show what it is unseen, what is unseen, beyond those things we typically associate with clergy, such as Sunday services, weddings, and funerals. The second result, he said, was that he became a Christian, and he hadn't been one beforehand. Maybe we should encourage photo essays of every church in the country. This is a classic example of what is sometimes known as the NHS syndrome. If you ask the great British public what they think about the NHS, they will tell you it's in a parlous condition. Very long waiting, poor services, dirty hospitals, underpaid, demoralised staff, terribly long inpatient, outpatient experiences. Ask the same people about their most recent experience in a hospital or a GP surgery, and it is, almost without exception, stratospherically higher. It's a classic example of my experience is pretty positive. But the corporate narrative that I adhere to, dreadful. Many years ago, I did some research, which I think I probably referred to more than any other research project I did, because I found it so formative and bruising in its own way. Interviewing people who were non-Christians, this was about 2002 or so, to find out why. At one point in the research groups, I said to them, okay, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to walk outside and bring in a typical Christian, just a typical one, and I want you to describe them to me. Boy, did they describe them to me. Witheringly hostile and critical and nasty. Not a good brand image. And then, in the same research groups, half an hour or an hour later, very often the same people would happen to mention a colleague at work or a neighbour or someone who comes to pick up my kids and take them to guides every week who happened to be a Christian. And actually, they're a really nice person. Now I come to think about it, I really like them. That wasn't the universal experience by any means. Let's not give us all halos just yet. But I'd much rather it were that way round, that people's actual experiences of their Christians they knew was a bit like their actual experiences of the GP or the hospital. The church suffers from a bad case of the NHS syndrome. This is just an aside before my very last slide. This gentleman, as I'm sure you will know, is the last pagan emperor of Rome. And his name was Julian, and he was latterly known as Julian the Apostate, because he wasn't very popular amongst Christian historians. Upon becoming emperor, Julian decided he wanted to restore paganism. This is from a papal encyclical, but this is all historically very accurate stuff. While reforming it in hope of making it the driving force behind the empire. In this project, he was amply inspired by Christianity. He didn't fall into the same mistake as his predecessors had done, which was to get rid of the church by persecuting it. That didn't really seem to work. Replacing it was a much better idea. So he established a hierarchy of metropolitans and priests who were to foster the love of God, pagan God, and neighbour. And in one of his letters, he wrote, and he's actually, this is one of Benedict's encyclicals, and he's quite generous and gentle here. Julian actually wrote that the impious Galileans, as he contemptuously called them, not only tend to their own sick, but look after ours as well. The only thing impressed him about the church's existence was its charitable activity. And so what he tried to do was capture that for paganism. He happened to only live for 2 years or so he never saw his wish fulfilled. But I think that's fascinating as an example of he wants an understanding why Christianity went from very little to an awful lot in the space of 200 years or so. It's probably that Julian was not an apologist for Christianity. He was not making positive points in order to win points. He's grudgingly recognizing that the future for Christianity in the second and third and fourth centuries was in, if you may allow me anachronistically to call it, Christian social liturgy. The report talks about what that might look like. And one of the things we're engaging on in Theos is to understand why Christian social liturgy might be different. How does loving God manifest itself in its love of neighbour? But as I was writing the report, I happened to listen to a news item on the radio. And I think this puts it much better than I ever could. And it's what I'll conclude on. On the 3rd of May last year, the BBC Radio 4 programme You and Yours looked at the issue of debt and mental health. You and Yours is a kind of a phone-in programme for Radio 4. And it had people calling in and connecting them with counsellors and money experts who could give them advice. Towards the end of the programme, I took a call from a 68-year-old woman whose situation was, in her own words, horrendous. She had major debt problems due to her husband's long-standing paranoid schizophrenia. Unbeknown to her, he had accumulated over £20,000 worth of debt through various channels to pay for his gambling addiction. He didn't work, and they were now afraid to answer the phone or open the post. The result was not only poverty and fear, but a radically broken marriage, in which, she said, she felt more like a mother or a debt police than a wife. It's affected how we love one another, she remarked with painful honesty. Martin Lewis was the independent money-saving expert and listened to her and tried to offer her some reassurance. He said that in many instances of major hidden debts, he suggested visiting a non-profit debt counselling service, but in his words, you are beyond that. He went on to say, I would say that the right organisation for you is a wonderful organisation called CAP UK, which is Christians Against Poverty. You don't have to be a Christian, he interestingly reassured her. Christianity was what inspired them, why they do it, not who they do it for or to. CAP UK, he went on, was different from other debt counsellors. Citizens Advice, Step Change and National Debt Line were all very good agencies, he explained. But they were functional, like an accountant who can sort out your financial problems. What CAP UK do is that they come to the house. They give you many more hours, and they also do emotional counselling to do with debt counselling. I think you could do with someone who comes around, makes you a cup of tea, holds your hand, talks through this, and gets the money sorted out at the same time. I hear wonderful things about people who have met them. Like Julian the Apostate, Martin Lewis is not an apologist for Christianity, so it is fascinating that he should say that on a national radio program like You and Yours. That, I think, is Christian social liturgy in action, and that, I think, is the future for Christianity in the 21st century. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Nick, we'll have time now for some questions. That was an incredibly interesting and very challenging presentation, and thank you for sharing your research and insights with us. I wonder, we've got a roving microphone. Do we have questions? I feel I want some time to reflect and bring them back, but we've got about 10 minutes now to share with each other. I think there was a hand here, was that? Yes, the gentleman with the pen, and then we'll come to you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting, and as has just been said, thought-provoking. I wonder whether you've done any study on the way in which we, and I count myself in as a Christian, that we Christians present ourselves when we are trying to deal with society at large. When the people in Colchester go out on the soup run, they're very often dressed in jeans and a t-shirt and a sweater, whether they're vicars, ministers or laity. When people go to the food bank, they're very often dressed in jeans and a t-shirt and a sweater, whoever they are. When they go to church, they put on all sorts of outlandish garb that the member of the public who is not used to seeing them in church cannot for the life of them understand. What has this person got on? Why have they got these fancy hats and strange collars? And why are these men wearing dresses? And do you think that in any way we actually are a self-defeating organisation because of the way we not only dress, but the way we also address each other when we are going about our activities within the church, whilst actually outside the church, we do conform to society's norms?
Thank you. I can safely say that's the first time I've been asked that question in the various presentations I've done this year or so, so I'm going to have to think on my feet for it. I have to be conscious of the fact that I come from an evangelical tradition which seems, at least the churches I've been to be completely allergic to any form of vestments or indeed liturgy, and that's kind of where I'm at home, but I'm conscious that I'm also not, I can't therefore speak for everybody like that. I think there are two things worth saying here. The first is your point about people dressing normally, Christians dressing normally as they go about doing, if you like, this Christian social liturgy is right, and it's, I think, important. I was struck by the advert that the Church of England put together, the Lord's Prayer advert that the Church of England put together and wasn't shown in cinemas last Christmas, because it might corrupt cinema goers or for whatever spurious reason, was full of people saying the Lord's Prayer, began with Justin Welbeing and full of people. And I think that's exactly the right register. In other words, these are people like us who have faith in Jesus Christ. And that takes away one of the barriers that are often felt today, one of those institutional barriers. So I have a great deal of sympathy with that. However, at the same time, I'm conscious of the fact that not just Christians, but non-Christians actually appreciate, and I choose the word carefully here, an appropriate moment, a sense of ceremony, whether they are national moments or personal moments. And as a result of that, I think they are, and this is a massive generalization, less anxious about vestments and liturgy than you make out there. There are certainly some that would say, why wear a dress? But I think in appropriate circumstances, when there is a sense of, if you like, solemnity and significance and corporate behaviour, I think there is a greater openness to the idea of that kind of liturgy and ceremony. So I suppose I would say, in its place, I think it is appropriate, even in an age which is, as you rightly say, much more jeans and t-shirts.
Thank you. David, there's a gentleman here, please. No, it's coming to you.
Thank you. This is not my question, it's just a comment on the last one, that a policeman has a uniform, soldiers have uniforms, people serving in churches have uniforms too, but that's not what I was going to ask. Many years ago, when I first married my Greek wife, we were travelling on a train, and a lady from our compartment went to relieve herself. She came back from the compartment at the end of the carriage, saying, "Then liturgy, it doesn't liturgize. The lavatory doesn't work." That was a moment of disclosure for me. I realised, of course, what liturgy means. That is what a human being is for: the worship of God. That's first and foremost above everything else. And if one doesn't worship God, then liturgy doesn't work.
It's a very good analogy. I don't think I'm going to work that particular example into the second edition of the book, but I understand exactly what you make.
Thank you. The lady here, David.
At the beginning, you talked about affiliation and church attendance and so on. But what concerns me a lot is general awareness about Christianity. And one of the things you didn't touch on was the family and children, because as religion ceases, or Christian religion ceases to be taught at school, and families become less and less engaged with church, so children are less aware of the possibility of Christianity. And that doesn't feature in any of the statistics that you showed. I just wonder where that comes into your research.
Yes, it hasn't a bit. We published a report with research called Passing on Faith last year, I think it was, which we looked at precisely this issue, specifically more about parents' attitude to passing on faith. A couple of things that occurred to me in what you said. Christianity isn't actually being taught less in schools. What would have been Christianity, say, when I was growing up, a more didactic and confessional form of Christianity certainly is being taught less. But there is an increasing awareness of the need for good religious literacy. Actually, we're running a series of roundtables at work about this, and it's a mess at the moment. So I think children are engaging with it through school, but at the moment not as positively or as well as they could be. Secondly, you're right, you know, the percentage of kids that go to Sunday school is now completely fallen off from what was astonishingly high, 60, 70, 80, 90% at times, and fewer are coming into contact with it through their parents. So we are moving from a society in which people have, to some extent, were de-churched into one in which they are unchurched. De-churched having been to church, no longer do so. Unchurched never went there in the first instance. And it's too early to tell whether that is good or bad. It could be bad in that, you know, if I'm talking to you and you're completely unchurched, we may as well be speaking another language. You can shrug and think, well, I have no idea what you're talking about. Conversely, it may mean that you have rather less baggage and presuppositions from having been de-churched. I'm actually more inclined to the former of those, because I think actually people do pick up ideas about Christianity and faith generally, and if they don't do it through personal contact, they will do so through the press and through media coverage, which is not entirely always positive, let's be honest. So I think that is a real problem, and the only way to address it really is, in as far as possible, to help children to come into actual contact with Christians. I mean, even if RE gets much, much better, I know from my kids' experience, they're a little older now, but they were in junior school and primary school quite recently, it was very often the kind of church youth workers or the kids' workers that would come in and do kind of a Bible assembly that was actually A, really good, and B, helped other kids who had no idea of Christianity come into contact with. So it is a challenge, and you know, it's another argument for more youth workers and more children's school workers, I think.
Which must be an encouragement to this parish. Yes, please, Dave.
Yes, I wondered if you could maybe say something on the subject of evangelism, but can I pick it up from the NHS? I think it's recognised now that one of the issues about the NHS has been a number of years ago, the government began to cut back on the training of people to be nurses and doctors in our country, with the result, of course, that we do have, we needed help. We needed other people from other countries to come in and help us. But it was realized that there was a cutback and that really we need to do something locally. Now, what I'm saying is that the liturgy, that the service of God in social action is part of our service to God, but don't we also want to say to people, we want to serve you in God's name, and also we'd like you to join us, so that, you know, because if we always serve but we don't make other people to become fellow servers, we are on a declining path.
So I think that's a very good point. The word evangelism always makes me slightly smile because of the old joke, the one thing that Christians and non-Christians have in common is they both hate evangelism. One of the slides I took out for reasons of time, but there's a little bit towards the end of the book, is called the account of social liturgy. So the last chapter articulates in a little more detail what social liturgy might look like. And it emphasizes the point that you need to be ready to give an account of the hope you have within you, but in a liturgical framework, if you like. One of the reasons why the CAP example is so interesting is that they don't say, we're Christians as well. They say, we're doing this because of the love of Jesus Christ. And they invite people, and people become Christians. I think that's evangelism, if you like, but it's appropriate because it is evangelism that comes wrapped in love and wrapped in service. And historically, sometimes at least, evangelism hasn't come like that or has been framed as a very cogent argument. And whereas I have very happy with apologetics, I think it has its place. I think where we are at the moment, it needs to come wrapped in love and in service. It will look different in different circumstances. And I think one of the challenges is for if you are serving people in debt, or if you are serving the nighttime economy through street pastors, or if you are working with refugees, or people who are lonely, or people who suffer from dementia, and all these various other things, there will be different ways in which you can actually evangelize. You can talk about Jesus Christ, and you need care, thoughtfulness, and to tailor it to the person you're engaging with and the circumstances you're engaging in. One coda point is that this will be an issue, because CAP can do what they do because they don't rely on government money. Very often, if you're relying on public funds, and it's public funds, not government money, there'll be some kind of edict in there as don't share your faith, don't evangelize, certainly don't proselytize, because that's an inappropriate use. And that is a challenge, because if I'm doing this because of the love of Jesus Christ, and I want other people to share and know the love of Jesus Christ and join me, being gagged is an extremely uncomfortable position. So one of my colleagues, in fact, the report maybe at the back, Paul, wrote a report about the problem of proselytism, how proselytism has become this boo word. This will be a difficult area to negotiate as we go on, that boundary between what is proper and appropriate for public money and statutory bodies, and the motivation of the voluntary sector generally, Christians within it. But I absolutely in entire agreement that an account of that love, an evangelistic account of that love, has to be in its DNA.
Thank you. And I think unless there's anything really bursting out of someone, that's probably the note and place in which we need to end. And I'll hand over to my colleague, Richard.
Nick, on behalf of the trustees of the Lectureship Trust and everybody here this evening, we'd like to thank you so much for making a long and slightly tricky journey this evening up to speak to us. But we're very grateful to you for doing that, and from my point of view, and I'm sure I speak for everybody else, it's been very worthwhile indeed. We've been given this idea, or I at least, for the first time, have been given the idea of the Christian social liturgy to take away and to think about and to reflect on and to pray about, and I hope it's something that will gain traction in our parish and traction with all those represented here this evening, so that a lot of good can come from what you've come to say to us. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thanks very much.